Good morning. I'm going to greet each one in Christ's name this morning. Generational harmony, that's the assignment that was given to me. If we think about generational harmony, what do you think about? What are we going to talk about? I believe the generational part of this title really represents a generational perspective, and which meaning translated that the perspective that comes from different ages of different people in your walk of life. So it denotes here in this title that there is a difference in our perspective. As we start from younger and get older, our perspective changes, and that perspective is limited to our reality and our history and what we've gone through in life. The memory that we have of our experiences make up our reality and our perspective. And harmony, we think about the word harmony, I think oftentimes we think about music, and probably the technical definition in the form of music, it has to do with the structure of music in respect to maybe the composition of chords and how that goes together and the sound. But there's a definition of harmony that I believe fits this title, and that is a pleasing arrangement of parts, an interweaving of different accounts into a single narrative. And that's really, as we think about generational perspective, and we bring that together, at different ages, different ways of looking at things and current issues that we face in light of history and the different backgrounds and experiences, we bring that together. What we want to do in that perspective is we bring that together. Harmony in that sense means bringing it into one narrative and to where the different perspectives blend into one for a vision. And our tendency, I believe, as we work together with different generations is that, like I said, we tend to look at life currently in the present by what I've experienced and my background and what has led up to this point. And so that affects how I look at things. And so, of course, as you bring younger ones to the table and older ones that have been around longer, those who have had a longer history, more experiences, more life, it's going to affect the way they look at things, and that's good. And then you bring someone who comes to the table with less experience, and they're not going to have that sight ramp that the older person has. Of course, they're going to have a somewhat different perspective of the present. And how can we take those two and make it sound like one, into a single narrative for a vision that we can walk together? Now, we're talking this morning about a brotherhood, I believe, in a spiritual connotation of working together in a brotherhood in a church. At least that's the way I'm approaching it. But really, as we think about vision, if you have a vision that you want to go, you want it to live beyond one generation, a lot of these things that we're going to talk about apply to that vision. Whether it's a business or whether it's some kind of vision you care about, something you want to go beyond you, then there's a lot of these things that we think about in real life that applies to different kinds of vision. But this morning, specifically, I want to think about the vision of brotherhood and working together in different ages. In fact, I prepared this outline that I have this morning earlier this spring for our church at home. And so before I was assigned this topic, and it was specifically for us as we think about doing and living out church life in our home congregation. So for the message this morning, it's maybe a little different type of outline. I really want to use an analogy and an Old Testament story, and then I want you to draw from that. And so it's somewhat parabolic in nature, maybe a little different than maybe what you would expect. But one of the as far as the analogy goes, I had to think about, in my experience, 3 years ago about in July, we moved to Boonville, and our family bought a house on 10 acres, and we purchased this house from a couple that they had cattle. That was their main thing. I mean, well, it was one of the things they did. And so on this 10 acres, when we purchased this property, it was a house kind of sitting up on the hill, kind of in the middle of the 10 acres, and as much pasture as these people could get out of this 10 acres, they got it. There's a creek that runs around the back of it, but they pastured almost everything. There was a small yard around the house, and right at the edge of this yard, there's some beautiful big trees. Some of them are oak trees and a maple tree. But beyond that, it was just pasture and somewhat run down. And so after we bought the house, I'm not a cattle farmer, and I wanted more yard. And so I tore up the fences and extended this yard out into what used to be cow pasture. And so when I did that, you look out the front windows of my house and the back windows, and we had these big, monster, beautiful trees right up against the house. But then out beyond that, it's just this new yard with no trees. And I wanted more trees. And so I hired a friend of mine from Kirksville that I knew, and he brought down some really nice young trees. And he helped me plant these trees. We went around the yard. I helped him, and we planted these trees in different places in the new yard, one or two in the old yard. And it kind of extended this blessing of trees out into what used to be cow pasture. And it's been dry up until recently in Boonville, ever since we moved, pretty much until this year. And so you plant trees and then it's dry. It became a pretty rigorous routine for me to be out there watering these young trees. And it was, you know, we planted these trees, we dug a big hole, and he was helping me because I'm not really good at this kind of thing, and I was just a helper. But we dug these nice holes and put these trees in here, and we groomed them and put mulch around them. We had these T-posts, and we drove around the tree, and we took this guarded wire. It's wire with some garden hose, rubber hose, so it wouldn't hurt the tree, and we braced these young trees. He said, you know, you're going to get wind here, and we need to support these young trees so that they grow the way we want them to grow. And I understood that. And so we got all of this done, and it looked really nice. But as the summer went on, I kept trying to water these trees enough. I had a root water that you stick this water down into the root ball of the tree, and you turn the water on, and it puts the water down in the root. And I, about every week, sometimes a couple times a week, I was out there moving the hose around and watering these trees. And in the process, of course, in the mulch area where we had dug in the yard, grass started to grow up in this mulch, and it started not to look so nice. And I had to be kind of careful about weed eating and taking care of this grass, because you have this tender young tree that all it takes is a couple nicks with the weed eater and it kills the tree. And I didn't want to do that. So I had to be careful with that. And there was things that happened. The T-post would get bumped by the mower and start leaning in, and I would have to work on this, maintain this to help this environment of this small tree so it had a chance to live. So these trees cost a lot of money, I thought, and a lot of effort. I put a lot of effort into this vision. I want trees, right? And I probably am going to be pretty old until these trees actually get to be big. And it's a long-term investment, but it's something that I anticipate in the future, and hopefully it blesses more than myself. So as we think about that, and then if you would have watched me all that summer pay all that attention to those small trees, you would have noticed that I hardly did anything with my big oak trees. I didn't hardly spend any time with them. They're big, their root system's established, they're very self-supportive, they can do their own thing, they have beautiful shade out over my patio, and they just looked like they were just going for it. There was one time that the one oak tree was growing out so much and the branches were hanging down, I had to go trim them so we could get underneath it with the mower, and a few things like that. But in comparison to these new trees, I spent very little time in the first summer taking care of my big trees around my house. But if you look closer at my big trees, there are things that are happening in my big trees that they need attention. One of the problems that I have with a couple of my trees, especially where there's people walking underneath them, is I can't hardly get grass to grow underneath these big trees because the shade, which is a blessing, I love the shade, but it's shading out the grass. And the root system is so immense and so established that it's hard to keep enough moisture there for grass to grow. It just sucks it up and uses it and takes it up the tree and, you know, feeds these leaves at 50 feet. And so it's kind of hard to get this grass established under this big tree. The other thing that I noticed as we lived there for a while and sitting under these trees and looking up in the branches, I noticed that there's branches up in these big trees that are dead. And I'm studying this. These branches are way up in there, and I'm thinking, how do you go about trimming out these dead branches? Do they matter? Is this just the aging process of a big tree? Can I just leave them there to fall out whenever they want to fall out? Should I trim them? And so I got a tree service to come out and take a look at this, and they said, no, that needs to be trimmed. You need to go up in there and clean those branches out, but we need to do this in the wintertime, not in the summer. He said, oak trees especially are fussy about how you trim their branches. So I have him scheduled for this next winter to come. He's going to charge me about $2,500 to come and bring his boom truck and go up in the branches of these trees and trim out the deadwood to clean them up so that this tree can continue to be healthy. So while I, an unlearned person in light of trees, could go out and I had this, what seemed like a really heavy routine to take care of the small trees, then when it came to the big trees, which I didn't have to spend that much attention with, when I actually looked at some of the maintenance there, I had to get somebody to help me, because trimming a dead branch off of this small tree standing on the ground is much different than trying to trim a big dead branch up 35 feet in the air. And so as we think about the nature of that maintenance, I believe there are similarities to these different ages of trees and different ages of people. Both generations of trees have threats to good, healthy productivity and productive lives. So the younger generation of trees, there's a routine watering that is focused on growth, weekly watering, tightening these T-posts, making sure that the string trimmer doesn't damage the trunk, because all it takes is a couple small nicks and you could kill the tree. The older generation, there's a maintenance also that goes with that of keeping the tree vibrant. Big trees that seem hardy from a distance, but if you let that big tree have something going on up in those branches and you don't see it, and pretty soon, if it gets bad enough that you can actually stand back and see it, it's bad enough you're going to have a hard time turning that around and getting it to be healthy again. So I believe the goal of the gardener, as he takes care of these two ages of trees, in practicality, there's different challenges, but the objective is the same. As we deal with the smaller trees and the bigger trees, the objective of the gardener is to see a healthy tree that can survive in the same yard and bless the scenery and be a different kind of blessing to the people who are in that yard. They both fill a purpose. Now let's go to Ezra chapter 3. And there's a story here in the Old Testament that I want to look at to I think represent in people form what we just talked about in the tree. We're jumping here in Ezra, and we know the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. You know, there was three exiles of the children of Israel as they were led into bondage, and then there was three returns. And then we're talking about Zerubbabel here, who brought a returning tribe of Israel back here, and his job was to rebuild the temple. And then we know that Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, all three brought people back in three different returns. And we're breaking in this story here where Zerubbabel had the people, and his job was to take these people and organize them to rebuild the temple. And so he did that. And they were working, and they came together here in chapter 3, and they laid the foundation. And at this point, they had already experienced opposition. They had had a lot of hard things to get through. And I believe that they finally got this foundation done. You know, after they had formulated the building committee and all these things, and I'm kind of using my imagination, they went through a lot of work internally, plus experiencing opposition from the outside, and they finally reached this point where they saw something in the ground. There was a foundation laying here, and it was all set to build. And they stopped there, and they decided to have a celebration, a worship service, a song service, maybe to praise the Lord for the progress and what this represented. And so if we break in here in verse 8, it starts to talk about this. And then it said, in the end of that verse, it said that from 20 years and old and upward, to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. Okay, and then down in verse 10, the scribes and the men came together. In verse 10, and when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, and the cymbals, and to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And they sang together by course in praising and giving thanks unto the Lord, because he is good, for his mercy endureth forever towards Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and the chief of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shouting of joy from the noise of weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. So we have this service that they decided to commemorate the vision of God in rebuilding the temple. They had a foundation to prove their vision, and they stopped to worship. But out of this worship, there was a different emotional response from the older people and the younger people. And so why was that? Well, I believe the older ones, as they came face to face with the reality of this new temple, they started to think about the grandeur of the temple of Solomon. And they brought back a lot of memories about how the previous temple was much bigger and grander than they saw this one was going to be. And they thought about how God had moved in that time, and they were thinking back to this point, and it made them weep. The younger ones didn't have that perspective. All they saw was the present. And they saw this, they said, this is great, and they were rejoicing. And there was a mixed emotion here that went forward, and people from afar off could hear this blending of emotion about this same event, as the older and the younger stood here and thinking about what was in front of them and what the future of this in light of their reality and what they remembered. If you go over then to chapter 4, this is a big story, so we're just skimming through it. But right after this happened, then there was opposition that came in. And they caved into the opposition. They said, okay, we have to stop. And the foundation of the temple laid, I believe, for 14 years. And the people, because of the opposition, they went home. And instead of building the temple, they built their own houses. They worked on building their own family future. They went home, they built houses, they started jobs, I don't know what all. But for 14 years, this foundation laid there and nothing happened. So, after 14 years, and I believe God... We know he did. He spoke into this. And that's the neat thing about this story, I believe, that blesses me so much, is that we can look into this. What did God think about what happened here with this foundation that was built, that was started, we had this mixed emotion of the older and the younger. What did God think about this? And let's go over to Haggai, and we can read what God writes to Israel here. After the 14 years, and Haggai and Zechariah were both presiding prophets during this time. And so God, after 14 years, he got up with Haggai and he said, Haggai, I want you to go and tell these people something for me. And this is what he told him. Haggai chapter 2, and again, we're going to kind of brush through this. But he's talking to Haggai and he said, I want you to go and tell them this. Go tell these people who got the foundation started and now have stopped and we're 14 years later, I have a message for them. Verse 2 here of Haggai chapter 2. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, these are the people who we read about back here in Ezra, who were standing here, who had the vision, they laid the foundation, and they had this mixed emotion, and then they stopped building. Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison as it is nothing? What is God telling them? He's talking about this celebration, this worship service that they had 14 years previous to this, and he's talking to the older ones, and he said, who's left among you that remember Solomon's temple and its glory? And how do you see it now? How do you see this foundation in light of what you remember? How do you see it? Is it not in your eyes in comparison as nothing? And I believe God, first of all, in this message, to these people. He was sending it to the younger and the older, but first of all, he addressed the older and he sympathized with their emotion. He said, you know, there's not many of you left that remember Solomon's temple, but I understand that this foundation looks like nothing compared to Solomon's temple. Let's keep reading. Yet now, be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord. And be strong, O Joshua, son of Josedek, the high priest. And be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work. For I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I have covenanted with you, when ye came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you. Fear ye not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, Yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. And I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. And I will fit this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And this place will I give peace, saith the Lord. And he sent this message to these people. So I believe as God responded 14 years later to that celebration of the foundation of the new temple, it was smaller apparently and not as grand as Solomon's temple. And yet he's sending a message of encouragement, and the first thing he did was recognize the perspective of these older ones, that they had a much longer perspective. And he gave credit to that. He said, I understand how you feel about the days going by and the grandeur of that and how that looks to you now, like here's something that's just going to be so much less. But he also encouraged them. He said, be strong and build together, and I'll make this great. I will make this work great. You know, he said, the silver is mine and the gold is mine. And I was there with Solomon and those people when they built that temple. Solomon obeyed me. But really what was grand about Solomon's temple is that I could dwell in the temple and among the people. And now I want you to come here, and I understand the different emotions, but I want you to work together to build this temple. And the great thing about this temple will be the same as Solomon's temple, that I will be here among you. Be strong and build. Be strong and obey what I've told you to do, and I will be there. And the blessing he gives here, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. This is a blessing that was given to these people in advance on the condition that they actually would follow God's command and come together and build. If they would do that, this would happen, that I will make this greater. Even though it looks so much smaller than what you remember, even though it doesn't look as good as the good old days, that I will be here and I will make something great. My presence is what made Solomon's temple great, and that's really what built the history of your nation, because I was in Solomon's temple. If you will obey me and build together, I will be here. So this blessing was conditional, that these younger and older would come together and follow the word of the Lord and build together. I will come and honor your obedience. The older and the younger are responding differently here in this situation. God is sympathetic to the struggles of culture and change. I believe that this struggle of coming together for one narrative of different perspectives has been going on for ages, way before we got here on this earth. And he didn't condemn the older ones for weeping. And he didn't condemn the younger ones for rejoicing. God made us to enjoy and appreciate the culture we're in. And in verse 9, he says that if you will obey me, if you will rise up together and build and make something for me to come down and represent who I am to you, I will bless you. I will make something greater because I am God. Not because you are so good. Not because of what you remember. It's not because of what you're doing now. It's because you obey me and I will bless your work. So as we think about this, and we're mixing this parallel, kind of crossing it over, thinking about the analogy of the trees. It's, I believe, understandable that we have the perspective we do at the age we do. You know, I have a perspective And I feel like, in a lot of ways, that I'm younger. I feel like that, in a lot of ways, I'm with this younger crowd that is rejoicing. But if I really do the math, and I think about what these younger ones would tell me, I believe the odds are stacked against me, that I'm really over here with the older. So God's perspective, I believe we see. We're blessed here to have Haggai and his message, God's message through Haggai. And we could go, we don't have time, but you can go over to Zechariah and see Zechariah was also a presiding prophet during this time, and he wrote about those who despise the day of small things, and he was talking about this exact situation, and we don't have time to go there. So what do we want from the two ages of trees in the same yard? Number one, each generation has its unique struggles with the present. I believe that's understandable. We need to accept, like God accepted that situation. He didn't condemn either one. He understood. He reached out and said, I understand where you're at. I believe we also need to accept that struggle for each age. We need to accept this, that each perspective is going to have its own struggle with the present. Our future is dated without young trees, I believe. We know that to be true. I know that if I had not planted these younger trees, and I'm taking a risk of investing in these younger trees, they could die. In fact, one of them died right out the gate. It had a few leaves on it that were green. They disappeared, and it never showed any life after that. And so there's a risk of investment. Whenever we invest into the future, there's a risk that goes along with that. But unfortunately, as we live into the future, there's going to be risk. And we need to decide, based on biblical principles and how God looks at the future and what he expects from me, we need to choose that risk based on obedience to God's word. To have harmony, we must have older and younger. You know, I can't stand up here and have harmony by myself. The very essence of harmony means that there's more than one part that blends together into a single narrative. And so if we really want harmony, there must be older and younger. There is no harmony where there's no mixed parts. And number four, multiple generations working together for a greater cause. So unlike the trees, as we think about people groups and we have younger generations and older generations working together, it's more than just about me living in the yard and growing up. There's more to it. And that is about me and whatever perspective I have of blending that perspective with the other trees in the yard to make one narrative, to have one vision, to propel the cause. So as we think about that, I believe there is a forging and building process that happens in that existence of different generations that is true for all of us. It doesn't matter what age you are. If you're not in the forge today in your life, if you're not allowing God to have you in the forge to press you into what he wants you to be, then you're not going to fit into this harmony, this narrative that God wants to build together. The meaning of forge is to form by pressing with or without heat. And the meaning of build is to form by ordering or uniting materials by gradual means into a composite whole. So we take different parts, we take different ingredients, and we build, we make something of one out of these different parts. And as we think about that in the sense of building church with a body of believers, we can't be a part of that composite whole unless God has us in the forge. Doesn't matter what age you are. The growing of generations is those that are part of that growth will be in the forge. We will be continually being pressed into a mold. And as I allow God to do that for me now, as I get older, he's going to keep doing that for me. That never changes. He doesn't put us in the forge and make us something and put us out the other side and now nothing changes. There's a continual forging that God would have for us as we grow older. We're continually in the forge. And if we're not allowing God to put us there, then we won't be a part of the composite build of these different parts that make one. So as we do that, we grow this generation of different ages together in the forge, a learning and an aging process that creates this church culture that we have. But in this production of culture, we must keep an eye on and make sure there's more than just the culture that's coming out of this united effort and vision. But this culture must be a product of spiritual people in the forge and who are living out biblical principles, and this is the result of that effort. The result of forging and growing and combining the different ages into one whole, one outcome, and one vision of the body. God told the Jews, "I understand the struggle you have with changing times, but build by obedience, and I will be there." Solomon did a beautiful job on his temple. He obeyed God. He did what God wanted him to do. But the grandest thing about Solomon's temple is when God could come down and his presence could be in that temple. And it wasn't because of the gold. It was because they had followed God's command and done what he told them to do, and so he could be there. So now we move into Ezra, and we have this lesser foundation, it looked like, physically. It looked like a lot less. And it's there in the ground. And God said, "Rise up and build, and I will be there." It's a never-changing God who continues to work with changing cultures and changing people and different ages, and his command is always the same. Just keep doing what I tell you to do. Obey what I want you to do. Blend this together, and I'll make something greater than what you remember. He was sympathetic to the emotion, and I believe we should be as well. We should be sympathetic and understand that different ages, there's going to be different emotions to tackling the present with the different perspectives. And we need to make room for that and understand that and listen to that and hear that and use that to build a composite whole. Then we have the promise. If we can do that, I believe that God, if he could write through Haggai again to us, the letter that he would write to us would look very similar to the letter that he wrote to the children of Israel here in Zerubbabel's time. And he said, "I understand the different perspectives, but I expect you to bring this together and to build for the future." Sometimes it's hard to have faith that God can build something better than what we hold up as ideal. It's kind of hard for us to fathom something better than what I've already experienced if I think this is good. He wants the church of today to forge and build with the lives of men of different ages. And that forging process is happening to us independently, each of us together. And as we blend that together, he takes that and he builds a composite whole of something beautiful. We must allow him to do that with our lives individually. We need to recognize that each generation has its unique challenges in this forging process. And there will be different emotions that go with that. But as we come out the other side, we can expect that this submission process will add to the composite build. We must have a blending of both of these to make something beautiful. You know, a healthy forest needs giant trees that will provide a windbreak for the smaller ones. A canopy of experience that protects and guards what is integral to a healthy forest. But how can a forest sustain itself if it shades out the younger trees? If all the good ideas and present must be built only from the older generation, we don't make room for the younger trees and their perspective on good solutions in the generation of church life for the present. What will the future look like? You know, the younger ones need to listen to the experience gained from a perspective that's much taller than they are. And it will work if the older and younger are united in a vision for practical obedience today. Combining the good old days and the perspective of older ones that have a much longer vision of experience, and they bring that to the present, and they allow the younger trees to invest, to invest in this vision and to contribute, and we build together. We don't want two separate buildings, one that's older and one that's younger. We want one building where we work together to produce good results so God can be there. There's a quote that says, "The error of the youth is to believe intelligence is a substitute for experience, while the error of the age is to believe that experience is a substitute for intelligence." Now, this is a somewhat secular quote, but I believe it shows how it's easy for me, in my perspective, to think that this is what we need, and I don't make room for a different perspective, because this just seems right to me. But you know, I'm not new. I haven't invented anything new. I'm probably just a type of the age I am. And I need to understand that that in itself has major weaknesses. For me to produce a build that is one build and that is productive, I need to make room for other perspectives that come from a different age group. And it's very typical. You know, my goal should not be to make sure future generations memorize my culture, but that my culture adds to the build of an obedient future. If you are older in the church, offer your experience to the younger ones with an opportunity for them to own the vision. Make sure your experience doesn't crowd out the younger ones from owning this vision, from investing. Make room. Put some sunlight in beside you so they can grow. You know, we could have this big canopy and shade out the light, and it would keep the weeds down, but it'd also keep the young trees from growing. But if you let sunlight in, you're automatically taking a risk, not only of you're making room for these young trees to grow, but then there's other things that you probably are going to have to work on, because the sun's hit the ground, the rain's hit the ground, and there's going to be things in this that grow that you don't want, and you're going to have to work at together. So there's risk to making room for the older, for the younger. But the younger ones need to remember that as they grow in the sunlight in between these big trees, that they need to give room for that perspective to trickle down, to teach them things, because there's no need for them to experience all of the mistakes that these older ones did as they got tall in their vision. Verse 9, in this place I will give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. Today, I believe the message is the same for all of us. Life is a forge. We are continually being bent and shaped. All generations should be there in the forge. In the forge, as God takes us and puts us into one building block in this composite whole, that is progress. And it's not progress about me, but I allow God to put me in as I disappear into the composite build of a vision that he can bless, that it's more about the cause and less about me. Progress is not always comfortable. When we work together in obedience, God will be with us. You know, I believe there's dangers as we think about working together and a vision that goes beyond me to the next generation. There's a danger there of a culture fossilizing, becoming a fossil. And we don't want that. We want to make sure that above all, above me, above you, that the cause is pushed forward so that it's alive. You know, I believe that as one generation lives out obedient truth, and that becomes a way of life, that it's easy for the light of Christ to die out of that, but the culture continues to produce symptoms of Jesus, but the light isn't there. And we need to be careful that this vision that we want to live beyond us, that is an ever danger, that we make sure that the cause of Jesus Christ is at the root of the habits that we produce. We don't want what we do to just be a form of something in the past. We need to keep our eye on the principles of God and stay consistent in practice. And as we do that, there will be risk that we need to deal with. We want, at the end of the day, for people looking in to the culture of Christianity, as they look into that, we want that to be an attraction to Jesus, not to just good neighbors. There's a story that you may have heard me tell. Brother Rick Walters told this story years ago in our church, and I've never forgot it. And I've used it lots of times. And this is about years ago with the railroad service. Before there was these crossbars that would fall down across the road, they had a lantern shack beside the railroad where the road crossed the railroad, the railroad would hire a lantern man to stand in this shack. And whenever there was a car coming, his job was to take the lantern out on the road and wave it when there was a train coming to make sure the car would stop till the train would pass. And there was one dark night, the lantern man was in the shack, and there was a car coming. And he went out and waved the lantern, he said. But there was an accident. The train hit the car. There was people that were hurt, and the people that were hurt in the car sued the railroad company, and this whole thing went to court. And when at the end of the trial process, the last witness to get on the stand was the lantern man that was there that night in the lantern in the shack. And the prosecuting attorney looked at him and he said, "Are you sure that you were standing out there in the road when that train came and you were waving the lantern?" And he said, "Yes, I was out there waving the lantern." And it was his testimony that won the case for the railroad company. The railroad company got off the hook. They won the case, and it was closed. And as the court dismissed, and the lantern man and the railroad boss exited the courtroom, they were walking out across the parking lot, and the railroad boss came up to that lantern man. He put his arm around his shoulder, and he said, "You've saved the company a lot of money with your testimony." He said, "But tell me now, were you actually waving the lantern?" And the lantern man said, "Yes, I was waving the lantern." But he said, "I'm sure glad the prosecuting attorney didn't ask me if it was lit." The principles of God in His Word must continue to be present and working in our lives. We need older among us to add history as an ingredient to current practical decisions. We need younger ones who own the vision, engaged and willing to understand the principles, point out the current challenges, and to invest in solutions. We need harmony between those two to build an obedient future. There will be no harmony unless we sing together. God said to Ezra, "Build and I will be there and bless your work. I understand the struggle of the age, but be strong and build together." God bless.